Elton.
Here.
Representative Hodgins.
Here.
Representative Ivan.
Here.
Representative Easy.
Here.
Chair James.
Here.
Okay. Garb. Zaretta, we do have a quorum to do business, so the first thing on the agenda is, it's not on here, it's under those previously heard. We have HJR 5. Last time when we left, we had a motion on the floor which we removed because we didn't have the votes. So if Representative Martin only has the votes, I'm willing to move that out. So if I could have a motion to move out HJR 5, which is the constitutional amendment for treating with conscience, Representative Hodgins.
Yes, Madam Chairman, thank you. I would make the motion to move out HJR 5 with individual recommendations on any attached list of votes.
Okay, is there any objections? Okay, there's no objections, so we'll call for the roll. Representative Easy?
Yes.
Representative Ivan?
Yes.
Representative Hodgins?
Yes.
Representative Elton?
No. What are you saying down here?
Representative Dyson?
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz? Chair James.
Yes.
So the bill is moved. Next item up is HJR 4, limiting terms of state legislators. We have Representative Terrio, the sponsor, here today. Would you come forward and give us your information?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I would just like to read my sponsor statement into the record. HJR 4 proposes to limit terms by limiting the number of regular legislative sessions a person may serve. The resolution proposes that a person may not serve consecutively more than 12 full regular sessions in the legislature. A person may not again serve in the legislature as a result of an election or appointment to fill a vacancy until at least two consecutive regular sessions have elapsed. In addition, when tabulating the number of sessions served, special sessions shall not be counted, nor shall time served as a result of appointment to fill a vacancy. Alaska voters demonstrated their desire for congressional term limits through 1994's ballot measure number 4, which passed by margin of 62%. Alaskans have also expressed support for term limits on the municipal level, with many communities adopting some form of term limits for local elected officials. HJR 4 will now give Alaska voters the chance to change the state constitution to limit terms of state legislators. Term limits are a positive legislative reform, guaranteeing that new legislators are elected along with new ideas. The popularity of term limits indicates that the majority of our citizens do not prefer career politicians representing them. Term limits will also level the playing field for challengers facing long-term incumbents whose power is oftentimes derived primarily from seniority. Placing a constitutional amendment limiting the terms of state legislators on the ballot is a measure that, in my opinion, is long overdue. Madam Chairman, I will just now walk through the sectional analysis. Section 1 of the bill amends Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution by limiting a person from serving more than 12 consecutive sessions and places the stipulation that the person may not serve again until two regular sessions had elapsed. Section 2 exempts periods served during the interim or between sessions. We didn't want there to be any ambiguity that when we're called back to a special session, that should be counted as one of the regular sessions, so we want to make that clear. In addition, periods served as a result of appointment to fill a vacancy would also not be counted because it may be only part of one of a regular session, and we wanted to make it clear that that would not count towards the count of 12. Section 3 The regular session served in the legislature before the convening of the first regular session of the 23rd legislature would be considered in the calculation for term limits. That, when this measure was considered before, was language that was added in the House floor that would basically apply the measure retroactively so that a person that had served 15, 20 years, or 12 years would not necessarily get another 12 years before being limited. And then Section 4 places the amendment on the ballot in the next general election. There are two fiscal notes, so the only one that the only cost associated with the measure is the $3,000 to put the measure on the ballot. And I believe this is information that I received yesterday. The NFIB had done a survey of its membership, asking the people in the state, or their membership in the state, whether they supported term limits. The support from the NFIB membership was 76%. And then when asked the further question of whether the limit should be placed at no more than 12 consecutive years, the support for that was 69%. With that, Madam Chairman, I will entertain questions if there are any.
Yeah, I have a question because you're saying this is not more than 12 regular sessions. That's 6 years. Is that correct?
No, regular session is the session of the year. A legislature is comprised of two regular sessions. So each.
I understand, but that's what this says. A person may not serve consecutively more than 12 regular sessions in the legislature. There's a first and second session, and they're both regular sessions, right?
No, there's a legislature, and it is comprised of two sessions. So this year, coming down here for 121 days, is one regular session.
And you're saying you can't have more than 12 of those?
Can't have more than 12 of those. So
that's 6 years?
No, there's only one regular session in the year. So it's 12 years.
Two sessions per term. Three senators or six House members.
We only come down for one 120-day session per year.
Okay, so then that does say 12 years, 12 regular sessions.
And the reason that it was worded that way is that I didn't care if it was time in the Senate or in the House or in the Senate, the House, and back to the Senate. I think that the people view our time down here as time in the legislature and really don't differentiate that much between the body.
So that would mean, and am I also to understand that this is retroactive?
It would be retroactive starting with the 23rd legislature.
Okay,
the reason for that is that the ballot would go, or the question would go on the ballot this year. At the same time that it would kick in, you could have somebody who's already served 12 years be elected to the Senate. You wouldn't want a person to just win election, the term limit kicks in, and now they can't take the seat that they were elected to. So what we've allowed them to do is fill out the four-year term that they were just elected to, and then everything would kick in 4 years after the date. And I believe in many states, when they've put this in, they have had a period of time that elapses to take care of that question.
I see. So, you know, what I'm trying to do is figure out how I fit into this thing. You know, and other people such as you who came in at the same time. And so at the beginning of, this is the 20th legislature, so there's 21, 22, and then at the beginning, so there's two more. Everything counts before that 23rd, this is my 6 years. If I was still here then, four more years. I'd have been 10 years.
Four more years.
If five.
Well, let's see. You are now finishing up your sixth year. You're right. It would be 4 years.
So it would be four more years. Yeah.
It's not enough.
At that time, they would look back retroactively. You will have only served 10 years.
Right.
So you would have two more years.
I would have two more years. But that would preclude me for, you know, the way it happens, our Senate seat is up in two more years. So if in your case or my case, or anyone that started when we started, if that person then, and their Senate seat was up the way ours is, some are up this year, some are up other time, then they could run for one Senate term, and then they would be done. Is that the way? Okay, now I understand it. Okay. And so it doesn't make any difference whether you spend the time in the House or the Senate. You could do it either way. Okay, anybody else have any questions? Representative Hodges.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd have a question, and suppose you spent 5 years or five sessions in the House, and then you got elected to the Senate, which is a four-year term, that would actually put you at 14 years or seven sessions. How would you, would that person then be precluded from running for the Senate?
No.
On his last?
No. If you look on page 2, line 3, notwithstanding A of this section, the person may complete a new term if elected to, if the person has served consecutively no more than 11 regular sessions previously. That language was put in there for exactly that provision, that if by switching over to the Senate to serve out your Senate term, you would go past the 12, that's allowed.
If I can continue.
Okay,
President Hodges. You have a poll in here, and it indicates that there were certain terms that people found more acceptable than others. What was kind of the... This was just in Alaska, this poll? Or is that...
Yes, I believe this is the... it's the NFIB Fair Crime of Alaska. This was a question that they had in their yearly survey, I believe. And I believe the questions as they're listed here were the way that they were put to the membership. And I couldn't tell you the number of respondents.
Then there's, I guess what I'm getting at is 12 years seems like quite a long time for a citizen legislature. And I was wondering if there was other times that they found more acceptable or if they just had those two choices.
I think this is the way that the section was worded. And the 12 years was derived previously in shepherding this legislation through the House. There are certainly some people that believe a shorter period would be adequate. Some people think that 16 years. And what I did is try to strike a balance between those people that are concerned that with a real rapid turnover, that increases the influence of staff, increases the influence of lobbyists, increases the influence and control of the administration, people in the state agencies. So I tried to strike the balance between how people view the number of years that would be adequate. Certainly in a 12-year period of time, if a person stayed in the House of Representatives, I would think that within that 12-year period, if they desired, they would have a shot at being the Speaker. There's only one Speaker, and with 40 members, certainly not everybody has a chance. But within 12 years, a person could certainly prove themselves, have a shot at being a Speaker, and I think overcome some of those other things when, with a pure citizens legislature, if you don't have a person that is elected that hasn't served in a city council or perhaps on the board of directors and leading meetings, building consensus, what have you, certainly within a 12-year period of time, they can come up to speed, understand the state agencies, and be very effective for a period of time in the legislature.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay,
thanks very much. This is an interesting constitutional amendment. It's sort of similar to something else we're looking at. It seems to me what it does is divide us into two classes of Alaskans, one that can run for office and one that can't. And I'm curious to know if there's any equal protection problems with this.
I don't believe so, because right now we have those two classes, those that can run for governor and those that can't. Those that can continue to run for mayors and those that can't, assemblies, and I don't believe there's any equal protection clause problems.
Do you know those limitations? Do you know if it's been challenged on that grounds at all?
Well, with a number of term limitations, in our nation, right down to president, I don't believe there's a legitimate constitutional challenge, a prediction challenge.
Just to follow up, would that be true of any other amendment that would divide us into two classes?
No, I don't. I don't think that that's necessarily so. But I think that's the way that that our government has been set up to allow this. And so I previously in arguing this through the House, that issue was not brought up. I personally don't think that it would be a successful challenge.
On that point, the legislation that was passed in other states regarding term limits was term limits of the U.S. Congress, senators, and representatives that was determined to be unconstitutional, wasn't it?
Yes.
Is there any other states that have done term limits for their own House and Senate that's never been challenged or has been challenged in a court?
There are a number of states that have term limits, and most of those have been challenged and are working their way through the courts, or I believe found to be constitutional. I couldn't tell you state.
So how many
state
cases have been found to be constitutional? Because they would only be compared to their own constitution, not to the federal constitution.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Anyone else have any questions? Representative Ivan.
In your sponsor statement, it says this research the voters approved 62% for congressional term limits, and you mentioned that the municipalities expressed their support. Has there been research as far as the state the legislature term limits are concerned?
No, there hasn't. I have not done this poll, statewide poll or anything. I've polled my own constituency. But I think I take it that the number of municipalities that have term limits and the mayor and assembly is an indication that people in the state of Alaska are supportive of the concept, and certainly the statewide vote on the congressional terms, although that mechanism would not be successful in congressional terms, was certainly an indication that the population is supportive of the concept of having a turnover in elected officials.
And if I understand right, this proposal or resolution would limit to 12, and if a person would like to run again in the future, they'd have to stay out another two years.
Only 2 years. So it really,
the duration of the clock, you start with a clean slate.
That's right. That's right. It really, I know a lot of people are concerned that term limits is a brick wall. This really is not a brick wall. It's more or less a speed bump. A person could really still have a long career in politics if their voters really desire to return them back to office. And we've had examples of people that have served in the 60s. Lieutenant Governor Coghill served in the 60s for a good period of time, was out of state politics for a number of years, and came back and served again. I don't necessarily want to preclude that. I do want the voters in the individual district to see what somebody else can fulfill the function, maybe fulfill it even better than the person that they were used to. So it just allows for some turnover.
Just the last comment. Thank you. As far as I personally am concerned, I think the voters are the key in the term limits, and they decide if they want to send a person again back to the legislature or whatever other office that they would want. As far as I'm concerned, I have another viewpoint. This is from the Bush legislature's point of view. We're always in the minority, and we depend on, we look forward for continued service if those folks that would like to run for office continuously and voters approve it. That's certainly an advantage for us, but I like it. I think it balances the representation across the state.
Thank you. Representative Hodges?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. When I was on the Borough Assembly of the Kenai Peninsula, I kept putting in term limits, and all my colleagues didn't like them. But when it finally got to vote to the people, it was about 80% of the people that voted were in favor of it. And those that had actually been so vocally opposing it are no longer in office. So I commend you for bringing this forward and trying to bring up a citizen legislature. Thank you.
Representative Hodges, I think, you know, a number of people sort of view a legislature or any elected body putting term limits on as somewhat scratching their heads, but I think it's the right thing to do, to tell you the truth. That's why I tried to come up with a limit that I think was acceptable in trying to address some of the concerns and what I thought were legitimate concerns. I think if you had a person that served in the House for certainly two terms, and then that was all that they could serve, you'd have such turnover in the House of Representatives that a person absent having some other experience that really prepared them for the job would be really at a disadvantage. I do think the system takes a while to really come up to speed, fully understand, and be able to combat and have some institutional memory to combat much of what the shenanigans that are pulled by the administration or bureaucrats. And I think 12 years is a decent balance to counteract some of those potential negatives.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I want to prompt a discussion, Representative, of something that some people would probably describe as a loophole. I'm going to predicate what I say by saying that when I was on the Assembly, I was the author of the Charter Amendment that limited terms for the General Assembly and limited it to a total of three terms, which in general is 9 years. And there was considerable debate on whether or not we would provide what some people characterized as a loophole, that you sit out and then you can come back. And part of that discussion was that, you know, that creates a situation for chaos. And you're encouraging a situation in which you have long-term service, people sit out, and then they come back, and so you're inducing a little bit of chaos in the system. I think the same experience has happened in California, and I think, Madam Chair, I think in California, the California courts may have just tossed out the term limits in California. I can't remember, but you had somewhat the same situation in California, in which you saw seat swapping. I mean, people would hit their term limit, they'd run for mayor of their community, and then they'd come back and start again. Why did you decide that a person could serve for 12 years, sit out for 2 years, and then come back? Because it does seem to me that you're encouraging a situation in which that you might not want to encourage.
Well, because I didn't necessarily want to preclude somebody from ever serving again. Now, you may want to consider amendments to the length of time. Maybe 2 years is too short for a person to go out and establish a private business, a job in the private sector, and really then do they have to consider, do they want to come back into public service? Certainly, there will be the opportunity for a person to come up to the limit, go and run for the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, but there's only one mayor's position. There's 8 or 9 people that consider themselves in the interior delegation or in that group. So I don't know that there's the opportunity for everybody to, you know, do that swapping back and forth. The way it was written up as the 12-year bar was to prevent the clock from running on the House side. The person just ran for the Senate and then swap back and forth, and two people could hold seats in the same Senate district and just swap seats back and forth. We didn't want that to happen either. I really do believe that most people consider our service down here is service to the legislature. It's not service in the House versus service in the Senate. It's service in the legislature.
I have a few questions, I think, and maybe comments. I've struggled with this thing a lot, and I've talked to a lot of the people out there in the public, and I know they want term limits. They also want campaign finance reform. They want lots of other things that makes the hurdles to get elected much more difficult. Quite frankly, the people I talk to in my district are not happy with government, period. And so that means us, too. You know, they're not happy with the general concept of government. I've always been of the belief that we have term limits at the ballot box, and that certainly is a good argument. But what it seems to be when I talk to the people out there about that is, no, they can't vote for that person in that district over there, and they've been there too long. It isn't necessarily because they don't want their own person in their own district that's representing them to be curtailed. They don't want somebody in somebody else's district to be there so long and be powerful. You know, I think there's a little ingenuousness in the public's idea about this thing. The other thing that you mentioned is the 2 years off, and what could you do in those 2 years? Let's say that someone young, you know, runs in their 20s or whatever, and spends some time, and maybe they haven't established themselves something else to do. Or maybe they're a staff person like you were. You know, you did other things before you did that, but you spent a long number of years of staff person. So you were ready to hit the ground running a lot better than I was, as an example. I'd never been here before. So those kinds of, and I said one time, well, if we're going to put term limits, why don't we count staff time? Because you're very influential in doing things down here during that period of time, and you don't need all that learning experience because you already have it when you get here. You know, watching you as you've been in the legislature, it's amazing to me all the things that you know and the things you know what to do, and I've been impressed, you know, with your ability as a legislator because you have that staff experience, which was very good experience for you. I didn't have that, so I had that deficit. I had maybe other qualities. But then so that's a young person, and they could come back like Jack Coghill did. He ran, he was here for a while, many years went by, and then he came back in an older age to do that. And there's people like me, you know, who I barely could get 12 years in my lifetime and still be probably somebody that could come on here and do that. So it's not a threat to me, but what about other people that maybe would have started 10 years before I did? And gave up their business like I did to do this, and or stopped doing whatever things that they were doing, because coming to Juneau to be a legislator is supposed to be a citizen's legislature, but you know that it's not really that way. It's a full-time job, 24 hours a day, you know, 12 months out of the year. It's just a little more inconvenient during the time that we're in the legislative session. So the whole issue kind of bothers me a little bit, only because when I talk to the people, it isn't that they want to have their local one not be able to be here. It's the one down the road or in somebody else's district that is distressing to them. We have very few of those. Even now, we have very few people that have had long-term. And on that point, I consider them a resource that, with a historical knowledge that sometimes I think benefits at all, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we don't want to forget what they used to do and do it our way. So, you know, I'll support this piece of legislation, but I have a lot of mixed feelings about it. I don't necessarily believe that it is in the best interest of the state to curtail the decisions of the voters in this respect when they might have a choice of losing a good legislator and getting a bad one. And with the campaign finance reform and all the other things that we've got coming to Juneau for the legislature, it really restricts already who can afford to run, and especially young people who have families. They really are deterred from taking this position at all. So I think we already have enough restrictions in the state of Alaska for who can be down here. I'd like to make it open a little bit more so that more people could afford to run, as opposed to saying, well, if you do run, you can only stay a certain amount of years. So I just wanted to say that. I'm going to support the legislation, but I wanted to put those concerns that I have on the record and explain to you how I felt.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Chairman, I just wanted to mention that my co-prime sponsor, Representative Bill Burke, is here if the members had any questions for him. With regards to the ballot box being the people having access to term limits up through the ballot box, we currently have term limits for our governor. We have term limits for the president. And you certainly hear no clamoring that people's right to elect the president to a third consecutive term is abridged unfairly, or the same argument for governor. I think if it was really a concern that they were unfairly restricted from doing so, we'd be hearing about that. We would have pressure to come down and change our constitution so that the governor could continue to run. If he's a good governor, if the people want to return him to the seat, why shouldn't he hold office for 20 or 30 years, as long as they keep returning him? We don't allow that to happen, and nobody has come to me and made the argument that they're unfairly prevented from expressing their will freely at the ballot box. And if this were on the ballot and were to pass, I think you also see an absence of concern.
Well, I just need to respond to that because, quite frankly, I'm not in favor, really, of dumping the governor out in 8 years either. And my reason for that, and usually in this state, we've been dumping him out in 4 years. But the problem that we have with the distress in the agencies, I call it the fluffing the nest. It takes a good year to do that. Generally, it kind of settles back down, the bureaucrats take over. But I don't know that necessarily that totally changing the guard, putting in all new commissioners, doing all the things that we do specifically, if we don't have one for more than 4 years, is necessarily good for government. It causes chaos. It causes a lot of extra money, I think. Because of that, we don't have certain people who are willing to do long-term fixes on things because they're only going to be here for a short period of time when you're talking about the appointed people. So I think there's the flip side of the argument, and I, you know, kind of playing devil's advocate because I really do plan to support this bill, and I understand that people want it. So I'm not going to take that negative position. What the people want is what they're going to get. But I still feel like there is a flip side of that that is not necessarily the best interest for the state. So, Representative Berkowitz?
Yeah, actually, I have heard people complain about two-term limits, and particularly after President Reagan was serving, there was a big movement to see about repealing the constitutional amendment. But that aside, I was only able to count three people in the 40-member House that have served more than 12 years, and of them, only one that I can recall would fall inside this amendment. Does that jive with your addition?
We do have a good, healthy turnover in the state of Alaska. I don't dispute that. In fact, if you look back over a 10-year period of time, the turnover in the state Senate has been 85%. The turnover in the state House has been 90%. And now what these figures don't calculate is the person that left the House and went to the Senate. There's no calculation of that. So I think a lot of the concern that's expressed that, well, 12 years is not long enough, we actually do have fairly good, healthy turnover. And I don't think that that's dropped down our institution. This really would preclude the few people that, in my opinion, what I've seen is some people that do gather up a lot of seniority and clout. They know the people in the administration, that maybe gives them a little bit more power than somebody that comes in that's brand new. I think this sort of levels that and makes it so that all people in the legislation would have be a little bit more equal.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Do we have anybody on teleconference on this? Not for this bill. Okay, and we have a co-sponsor. Did you have anything you want to add?
Thank you. I've just been here this morning to recognize the hard work and efforts of Representative Terrio and bringing this bill before you committee, and thanking the committee for hearing the bill, and to lend them moral and other support as necessary. I think the representative has done an excellent job of crafting the need for balance on this issue from the demand of the public, and then the need for some institutional history and leadership among the members of these bodies. I think he's done an excellent job, and I think I would ask this committee to support this legislation. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Is there anyone else here that was wanting to testify on this bill? If not, then what's the wish of the committee? Yes, Representative Casey.
Thank you, Mayor. I move that House Joint Resolution 4 pass from the House State Affairs Committee and individual recommendations.
And attached fiscal note. Okay, is there any objection to the motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note? Representative Dalton.
Madam Chair, I object just for purpose for a moment of making a suggestion. I mean, I think I know how I'm going to vote on this, and so I don't necessarily object to moving it to table. The first hearing, spent a half an hour on it, it's a constitutional amendment. I mean, I suggest maybe we might want to let this percolate at least until the next meeting. I mean, I don't. We've asked a couple of questions. We've talked about the loophole issue. We've talked about what the appropriate period of time is. And I guess my recommendation is that we might just wait until the next meeting and let the idea simmer for a
minute. Okay, well, I appreciate your concern, Representative Elton. However, and I think we've thoroughly, I've tried really hard to give, anyway, played the devil's advocate on this. So I think we've discussed it as it affects the state, which is a state affairs challenge, and the next committee of assignments judiciary, where it will be thoroughly evaluated from a legal standpoint. So I think that it we're ready to pass the bill. So, Madam Secretary, would you call the
vote? I'll draw my objection.
Okay, the objections withdrawn, then without objection, the bill is moved.
Representative Berkowitz?
No, we. Oh, sorry. Representative Elton withdrew his objection.
Oh,
okay. Next up, we'll have House Bill 304. We had extensive discussion on that bill, and we didn't put it to a vote because we didn't have the votes, and the sponsors tell me they have the votes. So, could I hear from the sponsor, Representative Green, on House Bill 304?
Well, as you said, Madam Chairman, we did have a thorough discussion of this. Unfortunately, some of the members were absent, but I think certainly the minutes would have brought them up to speed. Or if they have any questions about the bill, we'd be glad to answer them. But we're in for them.
Anyone have any questions about House Bill 304 for the sponsors? Yes, Representative Elton.
Actually, I'm not sure I'm involved in the discussion. What do we have in front of us?
House Bill 304, which is moving the legislature to average. Yes, Representative
Elton. Representative Elton, a co-sponsor here?
I'll see his name on the bill, eh?
You have something?
Not a question, Madam Chair, just a comment. So.
Okay, this is your comment.
Madam Chair, I guess what bothers me the most about this is that it seems we're being a little bit disingenuous here. But that actually happens, and I think that what we're recommending or what some people want to recommend is that we do something that no other state has ever done, and that's separate the executive from the legislative branch. I think that's a dramatic thing to do. I mean, I think it's the kind of a policy that is destructive and divisive. I think that the other arguments that we've heard in support of this, we have a building here that is not safe and that we need to reinvest, and I guess I just object to reinvesting in buildings and in new quarters for the legislative branch before we reinvest, for example, in a school building that you and I both visited that's sliding down a hill and in which underneath during the wintertime they store bodies. I mean, it seems to me that if we're going to invest in a new building and we're going to invest in new quarters, it's the thing that we want to do is invest first in Alaskans and invest last in legislators who are supposed to be looking at the needs of all Alaska. This seems to me to be just another one of those things that we're going to spend an awful lot of energy on, and it's going to be energy when we sit back at the end of the session and we're going to say, why did we do this and why didn't we invest our energy working on something constructive rather than trying to redivide the pie for somebody else.
Thank you. I guess, you know, from my position on this issue, our little inclusions, you hear that the people in my district did not vote to move the Capitol. And basically, their real reason was because of money. And although I will vote to move this out of committee today, I'll be a no vote on the bill because I, unless someone proves to me that there's a savings and not a cost to doing this, and no one's provided that for me at this point in time. But as we are, and I agree with Representative Elton, my big challenge is to fix our fixed assets. And if any taking any money for doing other things that I don't think needs to be done now, or in the immediate future, I think is not necessary. I will agree, and I believe that probably without this piece of legislation, that the legislature may have the authority to rove. In which case, you know, I've had some support for that in my district because that would allow some districts to have access to the legislature that don't now. But you know, the problem with that is where do you do it and do you have the facilities, and we don't. And so that would be up to the private sector to come up and provide a place for us to do that. So I think, you know, even though contrary to Representative Elton's statement that no other state has a legislative group separate from their administrative group, Alaskans like no other state. And we do have a huge state with a disproportionate amount of people in some parts of the area that are not served, and so there is a good argument for that. But I just wanted to put on the record what my position is on this issue. It is the money issue with me, and so I don't think the public is going to like us spending money that's unnecessary at this time. Representative Tyson.
Thank you. Let's see, I'm going to be judicious about what I say here. I suspect my capacity for cynicism is going to have to be increased during this session. And I suspect that we will see quite a few, and may have already seen, issues here that have more to do with what happens in November than what's good public policy. I also suspect that Representative Ellis Elton is correct that this is going nowhere, and so on. And I hope that the comments that we make during our time here in committee are directed primarily to the issues in our business here and not towards what will happen in November. Having said all that, I would like to ask the sponsor if indeed Representative Elton is correct that it is not in the best interest of the people of the state to have executive and legislative branches geographically in separate locations. Is it your understanding that the executive branch has the authority to move any and all portions of its operations to wherever they deem it is most efficient?
Well, certainly, we have already seen that many factions of the administration have already moved to Anchorage. There are more employees in the department, of both natural resources and environmental quality in Anchorage than there are in Juneau. The commissioners are frequently in Anchorage, and the governor as well as in Anchorage. So whether he moves his office, I think that would stay here, but whether he is available in Anchorage or any place else in the state, I think has already been proven that he is.
I probably stated the question poorly. Does he have the authority to relocate any and all executive branch offices wherever he chooses?
Well, sir, I'm not answering the question, I guess. I thought I had. You mean to take the commissioners? Or his office specifically, or any of the other administrative offices?
Any of the executive branch, can he, does he have the authority to move them wherever he wants them to be moved?
With the possible exception of his office, he does, and I think we testified the other day that one of the commissioners has already publicly announced that she will locate her office in Anchorage.
Thank you.
Reverend Hodges?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies for not being here the other day and listening to the debate that went on. I know that in my district that it's quite a cry to get to local government, serving on the borough assembly the way that I did. It was neat to see all the folks come in, if you were affecting their wallet or if you were affecting their way of life or whatever with whatever was going on in the assembly. And that's a real problem that we have down here, is we don't have the ability for the local person in the street to come down and visit with us. And I know that you probably visited this line of reasoning the other day, and I do apologize for bringing it up again. But I think it is very important. You know, government, this level of government costs the public money, and it costs them money for a reason. It's because we manage the assets of the state, and we manage the policies of the state. And to use an argument, I guess if you wanted to save the folks money, you'd get rid of government. I think it's very important to get government to the people so that they can make decisions. I would like to see a roving session where one year it's possibly up in the Fairbanks area, one year in South Central, and one year in Southeastern. And we did that with the Borough Assembly. And the Kenai Borough Assembly was spread over 25,000 square miles. We would visit Seward one time, Homer one time, Sladovia once a year, out to Nikiski once a year, and then Soldotna the rest of the time. And it did give the people a lot of access that they wouldn't otherwise have. As far as the cost of moving government, I think when we were talking about buying the building that we just bought last year in Anchorage, we discovered that the square footage of office space that's owned by the state in Anchorage is probably more than the rest of the state combined, or fairly close. And actually, with the acquisition of the new building, it's probably way over that. So in all essential common sense thinking, the capital's already in Anchorage. Because that's where the bulk of the state services are. And I have absolutely no problem in moving the session there. There will be an impact in this area, and I do understand that. And there will be an impact in the rest of the state. And hopefully we can come up with some ways of mitigating some of those negative impacts. But I think for the good of the people, we should get these sessions to where they can come and harangue us when they need to harangue us, or they can come and lobby us when they need to lobby us, when they can come and get in our face when they need to. And I think that's real important. Thank you.
Is there anyone else? Reverend Vyman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Most of the comments that I would like to make have all, most of them have come out. My bottom line, of course, interest is more access to the state government by everyone in the state, and I've certainly heard some comments from my constituents that that were so far away, and what little budget that they have was in the municipalities, is, for example, in Western Alaska that I come from. They try to budget at least a trip down here, but most of the time they modify it and get as far as Anchorage. We believe that they just don't take a trip for the sake of taking a trip, but when they feel some of the needs that they have to be heard equally as others, they come into Anchorage and meet with whatever department that do exist there. I'm not saying they didn't succeed, but I just wanted to be sure that they just don't take a trip for the sake of taking a trip, but when they feel some of the needs that they have to be heard equally as others, they come into Anchorage and meet with whatever departments that do exist there. I'm not saying they didn't succeed, but I just wanted to bring that point, and I share the same concerns that Representative from Juneau here have. We'd like access to, and what the result may be to this community. And it's already existing as to where I come from. And with that, I certainly would support a bill like this.
just at the same time, we continue to have so much needs as far as wise spending of funds across the state, and we do have a lot of infrastructure needs, capital items that are always needed in some of the programs that exist and help those that really do qualify or need for it. I just wanted to point those facts out, and since with more access, we get more involvement in the government that governs us out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor Delphi.
I'm sure, I mean, I wasn't going to say anything again, but, you know, a couple of comments have been made that just an observation. Access, I don't think anybody argues against access. I mean, but we have to recognize or quit assuming that we're still in the age of the Royal typewriter. I mean, the other people were as thrilled to death as I was when we got IBM Selectrics with Correctal Rip, and we no longer needed carbons, and you know, we could do a whole bunch of other things when we got computers. I mean, access is, we can't continue to define access the same way we did 30 years ago. I mean, access now means that we can pull up on the internet every bill, committee minutes, whatever we want through the internet. Access means that we can sit down in front of a video teleconference unit, and we can testify face to face. I don't think that we need to continue to define access in the way we did 30 years ago, because we can have access and we can communicate now in so many different ways. Madam Chair, you mentioned the LIOs that we have established around the state. I don't think also that anybody disputes that this state and the state administration, the executive branch, has to deliver services. And oftentimes, you deliver the services where the people are. I mean, and so I don't sit back here and I don't say, you know, Juneau's the capital, so let's move people back from Anchorage. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. That's not efficient. That's not the way government ought to work. I guess the other thing that tends to bother me a lot about this debate is it's a debate that we've had before, and it's a debate that we've talked about before, and it's a debate that, quite frankly, is very debilitating to some regions of the state. I mean, how many times do we have to keep going with this debate, and how many times do we have to keep voting, and when do we learn that we set aside some issues and concentrate on issues that are perhaps more important? I guess the final suggestion that I'd have is I appreciate the fact that it's difficult for people to get to Juneau. But maybe we should, if we're going to talk about moving the capital, maybe we should put it in the context of, okay, let's move the capital to the wealth-producing part of the state. I mean, let's move the capital to, you know, closer to the areas that are actually funding state government. I mean, if we look at it in that context, we'd be on the North Slope, or we'd be in Dillingham, or we'd be in Kodiak, or we'd be in Dutch Harbor. I mean, I don't think that we couldn't do it in Dutch Harbor. I mean, I think we can. I mean, we've got all the tools to do it in Dutch Harbor if we want to do it in Dutch Harbor. So maybe we should bump it out of the context of moving it to where the people are, and maybe we should bump it into the context of moving it to the people who are paying the bills for state government. But I don't think we need to do that, because access is no longer defined by somebody coming into our office and grabbing us around the throat or shaking our hand. And access is defined by palms, it's defined by email, it's defined by 800 telephone numbers, and it's defined by teleconferencing, whether it's video or audio teleconferencing. And we need to break out of the box that some people want to keep us in, where access is defined the same way we did it 30 years ago. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, in summary, thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Elton has just made my case. I appreciate that very much, sir. The fact that we are not required to be in juxtaposition with the governor or other parts of government. We've mentioned that they are already there in Anchorage, and certainly he has mentioned several means of communication that we didn't have years ago, and that the historical convening of the governor and the legislature was because they didn't have communication. It seems to me, though, that if we're looking out for the benefits of the people instead of our own selves, that these methods of communication exist between the third floor and the legislature already. But to then say that the public could have access because now each of them need to go out and get a computer that they can do, or they need to come down to the LIO and send the message, which is still not face-to-face, or have the chair arrange some sort of visual, which we have. We have a visual communication system now, but not in all parts of the state, just in a couple. It seems to me that because of that, because of what he has so eloquently explained, that's one of the reasons that there's no more a necessity to have the legislature convening where the governor lives. And for those who weren't here, I might mention that when the member from Juneau said that we would be the only state that would have a separation, where, as I mentioned before, the only state that communicants that are not flying would have to go through two international borders and drive 800 miles and catch a ferry to get to their capital. No one has to go that far. No one has to go through those hurdles. And so if it's just a matter of us communicating with other branches of government, that can be done very readily through the communication methods that we've already heard.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Green just brought up a comment that I just have to comment on. And they would drive through two international borders and take drive 800 miles and take a ferry. That's if they move here. If they go back home, they have to double that. I do want to point out that I think the city and borough of Juneau have been extremely helpful in the gavel to gavel. They've been extremely helpful in trying to establish the communications, and I do appreciate that extremely much. And I know that the folks that get to listen to gavel to gavel are quite interested in watching the proceedings. But you still have the majority of the population in one area, and that is really where the government should be. Thank you.
I just have one more comment, and then I'd like to have a motion to move this bill. Is that, we just had term limits up ahead of us, this bill, just before us. And one of the things, there's a dissatisfaction out there with the general public about who can run and who can do this. And the whole thought and theory of that is that people feel like they're restricted. Having the capital in Juneau restricts a lot of people from having the opportunity to run to be a legislator. I would think that if it was in a better location where it's not so difficult to get to, that wouldn't be such. However, there's a flip side of that. Have you ever wondered what it would be like if we put a call on the house in Anchorage? Now, if somebody would like to make a motion to move this bill, I'm interested. Representative Hodgins.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I would make a motion to move House Bill 304 out of State Affairs with individual recommendations and attached to some laws.
Okay. There is an objection, so Madam Secretary, will you call the roll?
Representative Berkowitz?
Pass.
Representative Dyson?
Yes.
Representative Elton?
No.
Representative Hodgins?
Yes.
Representative Ivan?
Yes.
Representative Beasy?
No.
Chair Jane?
Yes. So the bill is moved.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman and members of the committee.
What about Representative Berkowitz?
What about me? Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we have up HJR 50, and my staff, Patrick, this is my resolution, and my staff, Patrick, will present it to you. And we have someone on teleconference.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Lonsbury. I'm staff with Representative James. Before you today is HJR 50, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to a public corporation established to manage the permanent fund. And this resolution before you is in direct response to the administration's constitutional concerns regarding HB 81, which we heard last year. The Department of Law explained that the Permanent Fund Board was created by statute to administer a constitutionally established fund and thus the only way to provide removal for cause would be through a constitutional amendment. And we believe HJR 50 addresses this matter on point while striving for the goal of continuity, which is the major intent of HB 81. Specifically, it addresses Article 9, Section 15 of the Constitution by adding a new section to read that the permanent fund shall be managed by a public corporation established by law. A member of the board of the corporation who is not the head of a principal department is subject to confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature in joint session and may only be removed as provided by law. That is the heart of the matter. If you'd like, I could refresh you on HB 81, or we also have some distinguished Alaskans here to testify, and we might want to proceed that way.
Okay, let's go ahead and can you just quickly summarize what HB 81, is there anyone that doesn't remember what HB 81 was, which was the suggesting that the members of the Permanent Fund Board should be only removed for cause, and that both Governor Knowles and Governor Hickel, when they came into office, completely removed the board and started fresh. Since it's our biggest asset that we have in the state, it seemed like we ought to have a little more continuity on the board and not erase them and start over. So that was the concern. There's a few other little things in HB 81. It's not before us at the time, but I thought maybe just to know that much about it. And then we can take other testimony. There's a couple people here, and we have one on teleconference. So thank you, Patrick. Stand by. Okay, next, Jim Baldwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Baldwin. I'm with the Attorney General's Office, and I think all of you remember that I appeared last year and testified on the bill that you referred to, 81, and I thank you for taking me up on my legal analysis that the constitutional amendment would be necessary. But I wanted to make clear, so that there was no misunderstanding, that there are still some issues between us on the approach here, which is basically to insulate the Permanent Fund Board by making them removable only for cause. And I wanted to just restate and reinforce what I said about how difficult it is to carry out a for-cause removal, that it exceeds, I think, what you're intending to achieve here, and that just our practical experience with trying to do it in the context of other boards where there have been violations of crime, for example, that the individual alleged did not affect their service on the board, but it struck a chord in the community, and the community felt by public opinion that they should not continue to serve. They had a lot of difficulty in removing them from the board. And I ask you to recall the testimony that I gave last session about how this Permanent Fund Board is such an important board to the state of Alaska that it should be responsive to statewide elected official, some elected official, and not just being protected by the standard of for cause, and that I think that's an important consideration and why the administration continues to have reservations about this approach. But I do applaud you in your taking this step to make it be done by constitutional amendment, which is consistent with our advice, and have no problem with that approach. But there are other considerations.
Can I ask you a question? And if not for cause, what other language would protect us from having the clean sweep that we had the last two changes of governors?
Well, in existing law, there is the provision that the governor can remove, but he must state his reasons in writing. And we believe that is a sufficient protection of the public interest. The governor must go on record and must state why, and he must stand or fall based on his reasons or her reasons. And believe that existing law is fine to protect the public interest.
As opposed to serving at the pleasure of the governor.
Yes,
which is under the current, even though it doesn't say that, anywhere. It's assumed because there is no other definition of what, it, except for the terms. There's no other definition that says how the is or is there in the bylaws of the corporation. Where do we get this at the pleasure of the governor? Which that's the way it's behaved.
Well, at pleasure means the governor can remove a member without stating a reason.
I understand just that.
You do not please me. This law, when this law was enacted back in the early 80s, I believe, this was a compromise between those who wanted more protection and those who wanted it to be just at pleasure. And this is one notch above serving at pleasure. It requires the governor to go on record publicly and state his reasons. It means there must be reasons. It must be must not be arbitrary or capricious. That's the standard that he would
be. And so we don't have that standard even currently, right?
In existing law, we have that he must have reasons in everything that the governor does.
Are we referring to the permanent fund dividend folks?
Yeah. Well, yes, that he must state his reasons. That's in existing law. That's in Title 37. I can cite it to you if you wish, or I can send you a memo. Sometimes when I look for things, but it's, yes, 3713070. The governor may remove a member of the board from office. Removal.
Or just this board? Is that
board.
Just the permanent fund?
Just
okay, you're talking about there. Okay.
And a removal by the governor must be in writing and must state the reason for the removal. Like a member who is removed by the governor may not participate in board business and may not be counted for purposes of establishing a quorum. That's an existing law.
I don't know what the reasons were that Hickel removed everybody or that Knowles moved everybody. I don't know that I was ever provided or whether that was accessible to me. I didn't know that it was available. Could I get a copy of what Hickel's reasons were and what Knowles' reasons were for removing all the board members?
I can provide that to the committee.
I'd like to have that, please.
Okay. I'd be glad to do that.
Okay, Representative Dyson, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you establish for me the trail in law that allows you to say with authority that the governor can't be arbitrary and capricious about removing folks?
I can cite those cases to you, yes. I can provide you with a memo to that effect. When public officials act, they cannot act arbitrarily or capriciously. That's a basic level of standard that public officials must live up to.
Wow.
That's the news, isn't it?
Well, and pardon my naivety, I would be delighted if you would show me in your memo how that has worked and how public officials have been called on the carpet and forced to live by that standard. I would be delighted. Thank you.
You know, I have one comment about the board. From my observation, the people who have been appointed to the permanent fund board are exemplary. They are very well-respected people. They are people with a background, I think, that lends them to this kind of a responsibility. I haven't followed them line by line to see who does what or what does who, but I've never, ever had it brought to my attention that there was any kind of problem with anybody who served on this board that they wouldn't be, that they wouldn't be satisfying somebody unless it was a personal reason. Now, when they give the reasons, can it be personal?
It can be any reason, as long as it's...
So if it's because they're the wrong political party, is that a good reason?
I don't believe that has been any of the reasons it's been given. But
well, I'm just asking, what if it was? Because if any reason works and they can use that reason, I don't know that necessarily evaluates that person's ability to serve on this board. No matter what their party was or if they didn't have a party. A Green Party member, a no party member, a Democrat or a Republican or an Alaskan Independent, I don't believe that they had all the other qualities that I see chosen to put people on this board, that would make any difference. I don't see it as a political decision-making group.
My answer to that is I don't believe that it would be an appropriate reason to say that it for a partisan political reason. However, I believe that some of the documents that I've been referring to refers to a governmental philosophy for how government should operate or how it should carry forth its policymaking functions. So, in my view, partisan political is probably not the appropriate reason, but there are other reasons which are not related to partisanship. Political is defined, or politics is defined in the government to mean the art of governing, or the act of governing.
And one more thing, and then I'll go to Berkowitz, and I'm going to have to leave in about 10 minutes here myself, and Representative Ivan will complete the meeting. But in thinking about and watching the Permanent Fund Board and do their job, it seems to me like the decisions that they make, although intelligent decisions presented by all the facts from the executive director or staff or whoever is the one that has really all of the ability to make these vast decisions, that it isn't necessarily, it could be, but not necessarily a decision of philosophy as much as it is many times. It is risk, but a decision of facts. But it's interesting that both Wally Hickel and Tony Knowles have decided if the philosophical difference, and I'll assume that maybe that is the reason for doing that, that two governors who were elected to the state with nearly about 40% of the vote took it upon themselves to remove all of the people for a philosophical reason, when it's the most important asset we have and the management of it. So I guess that, I'm not a partisan person, but there's just some places that I think partisan politics doesn't lie, and I think this is one of them. So thank you for your testimony, and I'll be looking forward to your thing. But did you have a question, of Jim Baldwin, or did you just want to comment?
No, I just had a question of Jim.
Okay, then go ahead before he goes away.
Yeah, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing governs most contracts between individuals or entities. And you said that there's an arbitrary and capricious standard here. Is there something comparable to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing that's also at play?
I'm not aware of a standard like that. What I said, I believe, is that courts have applied general standards to when officials act, when they take their actions that are required by statute to do something. And generally the basic standard is whether the act was arbitrary or capricious. In many instances, it depends on the kind of act that the official is required to perform, and a court will give more latitude depending on the type of act. If it's an act regarding a leasing decision, the court may apply a harder look at the actions of the official than if it's an appointed decision where the governor has more discretion in what he can or can't do. So but the courts do have a basic sort of a limit that they will apply to the reasonableness of the action. And so I can't say much beyond it, but there are plenty of cases out there applying the standard to executive conduct, the conduct of public officials. If that gives any comfort to the committee in this regard, it's a baseline. It's not like, the heightened standards of, that apply in other instances, but it is a basic baseline standard.
I wasn't at all discomforted, otherwise I might have co-sponsored the bill, but...
Okay, we have... did you have a question for Jim?
I do.
Okay.
Jim, just real quickly, you talked about the high threshold that for cause language causes. I've been desperately trying to remember, has anybody been removed from a board or a commission for cause in your memory?
My memory, not. I've been with the AG's office now for 20 years, and I can't recall in the 20 years that I've been there that anyone has been removed during that period, and I haven't researched back. I can tell you that I have been engaged in a couple of efforts where we have attempted to. One in particular involving the Board of Fish and Game, where the individual was convicted of fishing in a closed area. And we were just beginning the process, and it was becoming very protracted. And fortunately, the individual decided to resign on his own. But we faced a very, very difficult road in that situation where the individual had been convicted of fishing in a closed area, and he was on the Board of Fish. And it was turning into, the statute said, the governor just has to give him a hearing, and then he's gone. Well, it turned into, he got a lawyer, we had a team of lawyers, we had discovery on his side, discovery on our side. My gosh, we have to appoint an independent hearing officer now. The hearing officer considered himself or herself to be a judge. We were involved in a full-blown trial proceeding, which was going to take at least a year to conclude. And then they were going to go to the Superior Court after that, and then to the Supreme Court after that. So it's not an easy process. And the only thing that I wish to place before the committee here is, do you want, and maybe the answer is a resounding yes from the chairman, do you want the body that controls $22 billion worth of state money to be that insulated from the public when the public is really fired up about something that they've done? Do you want them to be that far beyond their reach? And if the answer is yes, then I'd say you're right in supporting this resolution. But if the answer is no, that you want them to be more responsive, then I would say you ought to rethink this approach entirely.
See, I can't expect any of them to be out there fishing in a closed area, so I have a hard time relating that story to the permanent fund board. Because of the people who are, the people that have been appointed to the permanent fund board have already established their credibility in the public, and it is true, a good person can go bad. But it would be my observation of the people that have been appointed, I would be very surprised if there would be any cause why they should be removed. That's my personal opinion from observation. I think we're talking about a particular part of people up here that have really established their credibility, and being on the board will only make them more sincere, I think. And it's kind of almost like a pat on the back, or look what you've achieved. It's the cream of the crop that get there. So to my observation on that. So I don't see that that's a problem, and I don't like to have the cream of the crop wiped out and start over just when we have a new executive leader. So did you have a question of Jim, too? Thank you. Did you have a question of Jim? Representative Dyson has a question. Don't go away.
Well, an observation. A trusted advisor told me just moments ago that we in the legislature have diplomatic or immunity, and that we are free to be arbitrary and capricious and unreasonable without fear of removal. I'm sure that all of us are comforted by that.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Let's go next to teleconference. We have Earl Freeman. Yeah, thank you. Would you go ahead and give us your testimony?
All right, but if you will forgive me, just take a little history. I served six terms in the State House, the first term being back in 1959, and the last one ended in 1963. During the period of time that I was in the legislature, we created the permanent fund. And during the time I was in the legislature, we created the permanent fund corporation. And I served first on the Board of Trustees. I was appointed in 1987. And I served 2.5 years, but also the term I was appointed. Then Governor and I had a difference of opinion over the educational endowment fund. at this, and he doesn't report me. It's 1991. Governor Hickel appointed me back on the Board of Trustees. And I served a 3.5-year term as a appointment. After that, when Governor Knowles came on board, he wiped out the whole board by, let me be clear about this, Kent. When Governor Hickel wiped out the whole board when I was reappointed, and the Governor Knowles wiped out the whole board when I revoked last time. Personally, when we first created Firmament Corporation, we had some different opinions as to how to go about it. We ended up with four public members and two cabinet members, one of which had to be Commissioner Alvarez. And the public members, the four public members, their 4-year staggered term, and whether you write along long the term is up, and you know, as much as most of them, you know, the governors, he had the power to appoint and remove it, and if he did fight the job somebody was doing under term with them to replace them. And we didn't foresee the drastic heat acts of those who were coming in and chopping off everybody. To me, and I'm a bit of a fanatic as far as permanent, but I admit that I don't apologize for that. But me, considering, and in my view, the importance of the permanent fund of Alaska, I think it's kind of ridiculous to have a group that manages that much money, has that much responsibility to come in. And for new governor to come in and remove them without calls or without reasons or anything else, I was kind of chuckling to myself. When you've been talking about earlier about the having to give the written reason for removing somebody, the reason they removed, he just tells he wanted somebody with his own philosophy. Well, since I've been associated with the permanent fund for ever since it was created, I knew what my philosophy was supposed to be. Other people did, but I have no idea what his philosophy is. Anyway, my argument is that there should be something, and I think you have a right approach here, there should be some all the works that prevents the building from those coming in for whatever reason they come up to the night. If I know most only I know what the reason or I think most people do. For coming in and wiping out a board that has that much responsibility, it's important that you have confidence and the reason for doing things and all that sort of thing. So as far as I'm concerned, I wholeheartedly approve of the approach you're taking here, and I support. If there's any questions, I can answer. But
Do you have any questions of Mr. Freeman? Thank you very much for coming forward to your testimony today. I just wanted to let the committee know that I have to leave now, and so Representative Ivan will take over the balance of the meeting. I'll see you another day. We have him left for the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another witness before us speaking to the bill is Mr. Rowe.
Okay, this is the operator.
This is Gino and
state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Hugh Malone, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this legislation concerning the Alaska Permanent Fund. Like like Mr. Freeman, I've been interested in and worked on issues involving the permanent fund since its inception. And I'm glad to be here today to participate in yet another debate on that. There is, I think, a central issue that is touched on by this legislation, a central issue that is at the core of the whole idea of a permanent fund, especially one as large as ours is in Alaska today, and that is accountability. The accountability of the corporation or the fund itself, the accountability of the board and the staff, the accountability of an institution that controls, even in a fiduciary role, more wealth than all the rest of Alaskans put together and then some, probably, I suppose, certainly in liquid form. To me, it's a troubling issue. It's not one that was resolved when the permanent fund was created. It was not one that, in my mind, was resolved or solved by the legislation that, or the laws that we have on the books today. And it's an issue, frankly, that troubles me so much that I wonder, as the fund grows, whether we should not simply find some way to abolish the fund before the accountability issue turns into some sort of serious political and social problem for the state of Alaska. For example, we have enough money in the fund now to build several Susitna dams if we wanted to do that. We could probably do even more damage on the social and political fronts. So this bill does touch on accountability, and that issue was raised by Mr. Baldwin, I think. He called it responsiveness. And it's a tough issue to deal with. I favor the legislation. I think that the legislation, you know, it does provide some stability in the direction of for the board. Now, I've served on the board of the fund, like Mr. Freeman. I had the honor of serving on the board, both as a public member appointed by Governor Sheffield and as a member of Governor Cooper's cabinet. And one of the things I noticed about serving on the board of the fund is what's called, I think generally referred to as a halo effect. I mean, for instance, we might not think that Mr. Dyson here is such a fine, smart fellow, but if we put him on the board of the fund, he gets a halo around his head, and he suddenly becomes one of the anointed few that are in control of this money. And I think we have to take off those rose-colored glasses. The real reason that people who serve on the board want this legislation is they want continuity. It's not an easy thing to come on the board, to learn about the investment program, to learn about all the fiduciary responsibilities, to get some understanding of the nuances that exist in the permanent fund's relationship with the other elements of the Alaska government, and to carry out your job as a board member. That takes some people longer than others, but it certainly takes quite a while. And during that period of time, board members not as much utility through the operation as he or she could be after they've gone through that process. And the people that I served with on the board certainly took their fiduciary responsibility seriously, and the idea of having a major turnover and the difficulty of what to do as the financial markets change and as the policies of the fund need to be reviewed something that people are concerned about. So really the board members are concerned with the continuity issue and the ability to do their job. I think when we extend that into the political sphere, we encounter the shadow of, sort of cronyism or hacks. I mean, there's no particular reason why the political hacks that, say, Governor Knowles appointed the board are any worse than the political hacks that Governor Hickel appoints to the board. And so on that basis, I don't think that this legislation could be justified. I mean, one set could be as better or worse than another.
But the bill itself does something else. This is not something that Mr. Baldwin commented on. I want to cast a plot in Mr. Baldwin's direction. He is a senior member of the Department of Law, probably in that department the person most knowledgeable about these issues, and I see that the committee has been consulting with him. He is a fine public servant, and I would feel much better about this whole thing if the committee continues to consult with Mr. Baldwin during the progress of this legislation, as I'm sure you will. But in the bill, House bill, the work draft, and I don't know the status of this work draft, I presume it's before the committee for consideration. In the bill, the bill does a couple things that starts to take some of the political cronyism or the idea that the appointees are just political hacks away from the board, and I think in that sense it does make the board more accountable. The primary ones on page 3, where there's language added to clarify what is assumed, and that is the board members are in fact fiduciaries. They have a fiduciary responsibility. And I think that fiduciary responsibility and that language, making it clear in the statute, goes a long way to improve the accountability. Now, as commented, it's difficult to remove somebody from the board of the permanent fund if this law were to pass. Mr. Baldwin pointed out that removal for cause is a debatable issue. It can be litigated in the courts and so forth. I'm not sure you'd want to remove a person from the board of permanent fund if they were convicted of fishing in a proposed area, because it's irrelevant. What's relevant here is where the person's carrying out his or her fiduciary responsibility. And if they're not carrying out that, I don't think that you would have a lot of difficulty convincing the court if it came to that. So I think that's an important thing that standard be set in the legislation and that it is made explicit. The other thing that the board does is it adds a member, or the bill does, excuse me, would add a member that would provide for, that one of the members must have recognized competence and experience in investment portfolio management. The other qualifications for the board membership are a bit blurry. Recognize competence and wide experience in finance, investment, and other business management-related fields, which could be anything from running your own fishing boat to a pull tab parlor to Lord knows what. But this additional language does make it clear that we're talking about a fairly specialized type of expertise, and I think that's a good addition to the board. My comments on the bill, on the constitutional amendment, which I certainly am not a lawyer, but I certainly agree that it is necessary with the nature of the appointments to the board and the removal of the board is going to take place. My comments are I believe that the confirmation process that's set out in the legislation will result or should result in improved scrutiny of the appointees. Right now, the legislature certainly has the capability to review the appointees to the board and make their own decision as to their qualifications and competence. That decision isn't necessarily binding on the governor, of course, and some might regard it as a useless exercise. And I think that sometimes the confirmation process itself is a useless exercise, is merely a rubber stamp. But it doesn't have to be that, and it certainly would give the legislature the real power to decide that a person who has been named is not going to be a member of the board. And to give that person an opportunity to explain the reasons why he or she, having accepted the nomination, would be able to carry out the duties. So I think that's actually a major improvement in the process of in the accountability issue for the fund. It doesn't solve the accountability issue, but it improves it.
little nebulous talking about the accountability issue because we haven't had a serious question arise as to the accountability of the fund. But I will tell you this much, that when I was on the board of the fund, there were certainly investment areas that we didn't talk about, and we got out of as quickly as we could. And I think if they had become public, there would have been a cause for debate that not only put the fund in a bad light, but it would have possibly made it more likely for those people who basically want to steal the money and run off through some sort of political maneuver, be able to do that. And I think that's the risk that the fund faces every day. The fund, approaching $25 billion, invested globally, represents such a complex chain of transactions today that no one, not the staff on a daily basis, certainly not the board, not the general public, and certainly not a governor that's busy with everything else running the executive branch of government, can follow. So there certainly could be an untoward event happen in that complex train of transactions that reflects unfavorably on the Alaska political scene, presenting a scenario for those who are daring and to some extent strongly motivated by their self-interest to take advantage of the situation, whether it's building Susitna or siphoning off money for some other purpose in the heat of the moment. That could happen, and that could cause a lot of damage in the state. So I think the accountability issue is will grow even though changes like this are made in the law. And I have thought about that issue for some 20 years. I don't have a real solution to it. But I do commend the committee for this legislation. I think that the points that are raised by Mr. Baldwin are good points. They have to be considered carefully. But I do think making an explicit standard beyond this general one that is listed in the legislation, the general one would be the incompetency and malfeasance and so forth on page 2. But making it clear that these people have a fiduciary responsibility, which I would argue they have now, regardless of this language in the law, but making it clear on the face of the statute that they are not only in name, but in legally trustees, I think does put some real meaning into this cause